Hello, and welcome to the Further Podcast, where we explore the far reaches of the human experience, from missions to Mars, to skydiving, to blowing one's mind with psychoactive substances. These conversations offer insight into how these extreme experiences showcase the human spirit, and just might teach us how to live our everyday lives a bit better. I'm your host, Haley Maria Duran, and I study the effects of psychedelics and other out there experiences on people's minds and brains. So we have a really fun conversation in this interview. I interviewed Dr. Sean Goldie. He is a researcher at the Center for Psychedelics and Consciousness Research. So you might expect a very psychedelic research heavy episode, but we actually spent most of our conversation talking about the science of awe. So that is a little bit of a different topic for Further to cover, but I think it really fits well with our focus on extreme experiences. The interesting thing about awe is it's really a fundamental emotion. It's very basic. It can be provoked through so many different stimuli out there, and people can cultivate it in their day-to-day lives. So it makes it a lot more accessible than psychedelics and whatnot. One of the things we talk about in this episode that I really enjoy is that Sean talks a bit about a study where people were asked to go out and try to find awe in different environments. And basically what he found with this study was that you could go out and find awe just about anywhere if you went out looking for it. And I found that idea extremely inspiring. And while I was editing this episode, I actually decided, oh, I'm going to put this into practice. It was kind of a cold and disgusting day here in Linköping. I think people who have not been to Sweden don't realize that it's not like some kind of winter like wonderland or whatever in November. It is like, I don't even know what to describe it as. Like, it's being like in a damp, I don't know. It's really gross outside. But I was like, okay, I'm gonna go out and I'm gonna find awe. And I went on a little bike ride to this nature reserve that's right by where I live. And it's nothing special at all. You know, there are some trees. They aren't sequoias or anything like that. But I went around and asked myself, like, can I find awe here? And even though it was a little corny and silly, I started, like, to appreciate the trees around me. I looked up at them and appreciated how tall they were and the amount of like moss growing on some of the rocks. There's a lot of mushrooms too. Just the biodiversity of mushrooms in Sweden is incredible in the forest. So I appreciated that as well. And yeah, it did evoke like a sense of appreciation and whatnot, and it was so simple to do. So I encourage everybody, no matter what sort of environment you're in, to go out and try to find awe. There's always something that can spark a bit of it, I think, if you look hard enough. And you might have to kind of fake it till you make it, but I think it's a fun experiment you can easily do. Another thing that Further has coming up is we have our first book club. It's a bit of an experiment to do a book club, but I love reading and I love talking about books with people. So we're going to be discussing the electric acid Kool-Aid test, which is a time capsule. It is a very strange book. It is written in language that is very bizarre. The people in it are wild. Ken Kesey is a character, but that's not strong enough of a word. So just read it. If you don't have time to read all of it before November 23rd, that's fine. You can read some of it and just show up for the vibes. That's cool too. But yeah, there is a Discord for that. Please join it if you are at all interested. And we have a lot more exciting episodes coming up. Yeah, and if you enjoy this episode, please share it with somebody who you think might also enjoy it. That's how you know, the further community can be built. And that's really what I would like this to be. I'd like it to be a community. So yeah, and with that, let's get into the actual interview with Dr. Sean Goldie. All right, so I'm here with Sean Goldie, and he is going to tell us a bit today about how awe can enhance our well-being, make us more pro-social, and how it might tie into people's experiences with psychedelics. So to get us started, I guess maybe you could tell us the story of how you got inspired to study awe in the first place.
Yeah, absolutely. So trying to make a long story short, but the gist of it is basically when I was in undergrad in college, I come from like a first gen student background, and I kind of fell into college being like, all right, this is just what you're supposed to do. Why are you here? To get a job, I should study like business or something like that. And yeah, I was actually an economics major for a period of time. And surprise, surprise for me, after a while, that was like miserable. I'm like, why am I studying this? Why am I doing this? This isn't like speaking to me in a certain way. All these like big existential crises happen, which, you know, story of many a person's life, I think, at that period of time. And, you know, I knew I was interested in like behavior and things like that, and dove into a psychology degree, got involved in a variety of different labs. And one of them, we were kind of, the professor there was talking about like these differences between like ancient culture and the way that people have perhaps evolved psychologically over thousands of years to what we're doing right now. And what we're doing right now seems in many ways kind of antithetical to that. You know, we live in these environments that are, the kind of returns we get, our investments tend to be very delayed. You might get an education for years and years. You're studying forever to get a degree that might come along. Very different than being a hunter-gatherer and things like that. And this is obviously kind of like a really watered-down version of like anthropological history and that kind of thing. But it got us thinking into what are the ways that people can get back into a mindset that maybe makes them more aligned with, quote, who they are, or their authentic self in a way that's perhaps a little bit more present focused or egalitarian, compassion about others. And so we would talk about things like near-death experiences, like meditation, like these really intense kind of travel experiences where you're in a different culture. Psychedelics, of course, came up. And so I'm thinking to myself, I'm like, all right, this is hitting on a lot of things. Like people often talk about research is me-search. I think it's absolutely true in my case, because here I was trying to be like, what, you know, what's a thing, what's an experience, whatever it might be that kind of might get me more aligned with, quote, who I think like I should be, or maybe like what is my more authentic sense of self absent these other sort of constraints in the environment. I was looking at grad school, and lo and behold, I came across this article in the New York Times that was talking about awe. And at this school, UC Irvine, I hadn't even heard of that campus of the University of California. And I was like, wait a second, this is exactly what I'm looking into. We're talking about this experience that's sort of transformative, shifts your worldview perspective, seems to make people more compassionate, more caring about others, more connecting. And that just hit on so many different, I guess, marks for myself. What I was looking for, what I was interested in, and trying to get a better understanding of how can you, what do those experiences do, and how can you bring them about for people? Yeah, that's kind of that's the medium long story.
yeah. I can definitely understand being drawn to really sort of extreme experiences of all sorts, from like near death to like just different cultures and all of that. And, you know, I think awe is like, even though it's just an emotion, there's a lot of ways in which it can be quite extreme. Like by definition, you are like breaking down like your belief system with awe.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's really fascinating because it seems to, although like, if, you know, course, like science makes you have to hone in on something so specific and like define it in a specific box as, let's say, it's an emotion, it does these certain things. But just as you're saying, if you kind of like zoom out from it, there's so many different things that can bring about awe. It's a pretty multifaceted, I'd say, experience. Yes, it is an emotion, but it can involve, as we're kind of finding out with the science, a variety of other different feelings too that come along with it. Yeah, and it just like all it spoke to this like core part of me that's always been interested in these sort of, you know, mysterious kind of amorphous things that are hard to put your thumb on and make you think about things in a different way. And here was a way that people were trying to do it scientifically, which was really interesting.
So then you decided you were going to basically try to quantify something that is so, can be so intense and ineffable. Yeah. So what did some of those first studies that you conduct examining look like?
Yeah. You hit the nail on the head in terms of trying to quantify these experiences that I would say in many ways are ineffable. And it's tough is what I found out over the course of my PhD. So some of the early ones I was involved with, I was very fortunate in being involved with a project through the U.S. Forest Service, where we wanted to see if certain experiences out in nature evoked different levels of not only awe, but also different types of emotions, and compared it to experiences you might have walking in, say, like an urban environment. We wanted to go about this in a way where you're actually like comparing it to something else rather than just like a static experience in nature. So this was a project that's still, we're still like working on it and years later in terms of data and things like that, but it involved going to Sequoia National Forest, so the great big sequoia trees, to Angeles National Forest, which was like close to where I was in Orange County, Southern California, which is right smack dab next to Los Angeles. And then our third site was actually in Santa Monica, or the Third Street Promenade, which, you know, it's an urban area, like a shopping area, that kind of thing. So we surveyed people at each site. We went to it and we had our little iPads and things out there, and we had LaCroix and other things to offer to people so they actually would care about coming over to our study, who were visiting that day and graciously taking time out of their day to take a survey. And we'd get them before they went on a walk and then after. So at Santa Monica, it was down and back from the promenade. In Angeles National Forest, it was a similar distance there and back within the forest itself, which is kind of a normal, let's say, quote, normal looking nature environment. You're there, it's trees, that sort of thing. And then Sequoia, obviously, they were taking a path on, it's called the Path of 100 Giants in Sequoia National Forest, where you're able to see the massive, massive sequoia trees out there. And we surveyed people before on a variety of different things, who they are, how much nature they get into often, that kind of thing. But also, what other emotions that they're feeling like right then. We're also looking at saliva samples even. So this involved us having to go and get dry ice every morning and get people to spit in a little vial and shove that on the dry ice immediately so it gets frozen. And then they would do all of that at the end. And so they'd come back and we'd finish up with them. And that study, I guess, yeah, for any of the people who might be listening on this and wondering about like field work, it's intense. Field work is really difficult, from experiences I've had with doing with like big data to just surveys to like, yeah, stuff out in the open. You're dealing with people and you're dealing with like the elements and things like that. So it's messy, but interesting. And to drill down on like what we found here, some of the takeaways were that people in Sequoia National Forest, they showed increases in awe, in contentment, and in gratitude. So this sort of like sense of calmness, and then gratitude about reciprocity and acknowledging other people, and then obviously the sense of awe. But the interesting thing is we also found that in Angeles National Forest, so the two nature sites, and we didn't find those changes, those increases in Santa Monica. So statistically, we found that no matter where you were in nature, the two sites that we saw, obviously, just the two, they're increasing the same way. That to us was like super surprising. You would think the most awe-inspiring thing would be Sequoia. But we actually didn't find that necessarily. So the moral of the story for us was that it seems as though when you have the ability to kind of pick where you want to go and maybe take like some time out of your day to go and travel, the folks who are going to Sequoia, they're often coming from several hours away. It's like it's maybe 3-4 hours from LA, somewhere close to that, maybe 6 from other areas of California, San Francisco, or they were coming from out of state or out of the country. Compared to Angeles, most of the people there were driving about 30 minutes or so. So when we're talking about like what are possible benefits that you can have from experiencing these emotions, and there's a variety of like well-being and health benefits. When you're trying to plan out what you want to do, and you go like, well, if I want to have something that's awe-inspiring, I probably have to go to the Grand Canyon, right? Like I have to go to this big old trip. That's not necessarily the case. And it doesn't mean that those things aren't still good. But I think there's an interesting kind of like silver lining here that you can find like those emotions and experiences in more, quote, everyday experiences, everyday nature. Yeah.
Yeah, there's another study that you did that I came across where you were just kind of asking people to cultivate awe more in their daily lives. And that seemed to work for people. And the instructions were really simple. So,
Yeah, exactly. Like if you're able to just like take a moment, and instructions often involve like, okay, kind of pause, pay attention to what's going on around you, try to see things in a different light. That can be enough just to notice something or put you in the mindset that makes you a little bit more prone to feeling awe. So we did some work on that. There's some other interesting work where they had seniors actually go out and go on these walks that involved either looking for awe or not, just like going doing something recreationally. And this was over the course of multiple days. And right, these are older adults who have gone on these walks that they're taking typically quite often. They're really familiar with it. But they were able to increase like a sense of awe just from that. Because if you like think about like your daily, maybe like a daily commute, or maybe it's coming from to your car, or from where you park your bike to, you know, your office, that sort of thing. There's probably all sorts of things you don't even notice for a variety of like good reasons. But also like, maybe it sounds hokey, but just like the aspect of like, let's look at like how the light falls upon like these leaves here, or maybe like if there's certain flowers nearby, or you paying attention to the air or birds and things like that. Yes, maybe it sounds a little kumbaya, but that's like enough to get people to just pay attention a little bit more and then report feeling awe. And the interesting thing about that is that if you feel awe, it's related to a host of interesting outcomes like decreases in stress, feeling more present focused, feeling more connected to others, and things like that.
It's amazing how simple an intervention can be. Like just noticing more of your everyday environment. It kind of reminds you of like how people say psychedelics make the ordinary sublime. So maybe you just need to shift your perspective and you can have just a bit of a psychedelic-like experience every day. Another cool study that you did actually involved Twitter, of all things, and solar eclipses. So maybe you can tell us a bit about how I intersected with that.
Yeah, that was a really fun one. So as I mentioned, it can be tough to study odd things like that. In like make it in a quantitative sense, put it in certain boxes. And so the course of my PhD, as what often happens in PhD, you get real frustrated with the work that you're doing. And I was, you know, running certain studies, and you know, people probably, they might have heard like the file drawer problem, where you've run studies and maybe they don't, quote, work out. And so it's tough to get them published, or like an experiment doesn't have like this big effect you're looking for. And I was going, yeah, it's tough. Like, unless we got people like out in nature or something, basically like hitting them over the head with awe, you know, you're not getting the effects that you would think. And in many ways, that kind of makes sense to me, because I think some people would have participants come in and like sit at a computer, watch a video, and maybe they're scoring like, yes, like I feel higher awe on a scale of 1 to 7 versus to the other group that watched, I don't know, just a bunch of videos of a guy making a table and that didn't give me any emotions. And you're like, great, okay, so they felt that, but was that really an awe experience? Did that really like change aspects of how they think about themselves and others? I would think not. And I was kind of like finding that out. So I was curious about like what other ways can you really study these experiences as they might actually like unfold for people out there in the real world. Something like you would call like ecologically valid, something you're actually like experiencing out there. And around that time during my PhD, there was the 2017 solar eclipse that had its path totality, right? So where like the sun actually gets completely blocked out by the moon and things go dark, it spanned the entire US. And so it meant that there were potentially millions of people flocking to see this thing. If you're around during that time, right, you probably remember like all sorts of stuff on Twitter and events going on and things like that. So here was this big event. Seems like it would be very clearly awe-inspiring if there ever was going to be something. The sun's going dark during the day. Birds start chirping that are normally nocturnal. All sorts of interesting things are happening. But how can you study this? How can you capture that? And that's where I was trying to like think a little bit more creatively. Around that time, stuff was booming in terms of psychology and other fields getting involved with big data approaches, using natural language processing, things like that. And social media was obviously like a bit of like more in its heyday, I guess you could call it back then, if anything. And that's where like the light bulb sort of went off of like, oh, like, okay, so there's probably some ways here that you can use social media. Like if people are like talking about their experiences on there, and there's this rich history in psychology and other fields of using people's language, their words, as a window into their thoughts and feelings. There enters Twitter. This was back in the day where you could access Twitter data for free and use that data for research purposes. We were very lucky back then. So we went about capturing this. If like people were actually going to experience the eclipse and they were going to write about it on Twitter, maybe that's a way that you can get a sense of what they're saying. So we scraped millions of tweets. We took a variety of different approaches to figure out like where people were. So like just by virtue of, was their location listed on their profile? Was it within one of the thousands of different cities, hamlets, villages? This whole list of places that fell under the eclipse's path totality across the US. Basically coded every tweet for that and get a sense of people who were in the path versus who were not. What were they tweeting on that day? The people who are in the path were tweeting more awe-related words. So we came up with our own like dictionary. And we also found that people who are in the path of the eclipse and tweeting about it were also more likely to use language that conveyed like a sense of prosociality, of connection, of less self-focused words. So they're using less first-person singular pronouns, like I, me, mine, but they're using more first-person plural pronouns, like we, our, and us, using words like friends and connection and giving thanks versus and you could actually see a decrease, right, in the first person singular pronouns. Then with that, drilled down a little bit more and said, okay, if that's the case, people are in the path, using more awe, using this. We don't have like a causal connection necessarily, but we should be able to find if people who were especially awe-inspired, they should be the ones that would show the greatest increases in these outcomes that we've tied in experiments to awe. So the prosocial behavior, the self-focus, that sort of thing. And that's what we found. We took a machine learning approach, clustered people based on how much awe they expressed over time from before to during to after the eclipse, and found that the folks who used the most awe, who were like the most, saw the biggest changes from before the eclipse to actually when it happened, those are the ones that are also the most likely to use those more pro-social connection-y kind of words and language. And yeah, that was it in a nutshell. It was really interesting and cool to be able to study something that was actually unfolding out there and then use this kind of big language, big data approach to capture it too.
Yeah, I guess it shows that social media sometimes can be used for good purposes.
yeah, emphasis on the sometimes there. Exactly.
Yeah. So aside from studying awe out in nature and in people's everyday lives, awe also plays a big role in the effects of psychedelics. Maybe you could tell us a bit about that as well.
Yeah, happy to. So psychedelics, right, we know bring about a host of different subjective experiences, rich in terms of the different thoughts that people might have, sensations, perhaps different visual perceptions, and then emotions. And what's going on there, I think, within the field has been interesting for a while, because I think from just like virtue of the training of the people who've been involved in the field for a long time and where they've come from for studying these types of effects, often comes from a background of looking at emotion as like affect. So when we think about affect, it's often considered as like positive versus negative, or maybe there's like a little bit more specificity some people have had, but you often see that in a lot of the literature of like, okay, so we saw an increase in positive emotions, we saw a decrease in negative emotions, and then we're going to talk about all this different stuff regarding mystical experiences and so on and so forth. But as I was just like talking about here, right, And from what I had been involved with through my PhD, was there's this whole very rich like literature on emotions and like the different types of behaviors that can be attributed to emotions, and that they seems as though there are very distinct ones. So awe has a profile of behavior, has profile of facial expressions, just as other distinct emotions appear to as well, at least based on some data. So when we think about like what awe is, and I guess we haven't really like touched exactly on this like specific definition of it, but the classic definition of awe is that it involves a sense of vastness. So something larger than your sense of self, you're perceiving it. It doesn't have to be physical necessarily. Obviously, that's probably the most like salient one. If you're on a mountaintop and you're looking out at this immense vista, right? Something very big, much bigger than you. But it could also be in other ways. So people feel awe from, other people. And it could be the depth of a talent of an artist. Or maybe you're like a physicist and like thinking about how physics underlie so many aspects of our lives and the laws of the universe and so on in this huge way that's like perceptually, conceptually much bigger than you, and the sense of vastness. Then the other component of awe is what we call like a need for accommodation, which is this kind of jargony term that just means that you're experiencing something that defies your expectations. So when we come into a situation, right, we typically have like a script for how that situation is going to unfold. You're walking into the supermarket, you know that, okay, like meats and cheeses over here and like canned goods, blah, blah, blah. It's a very simple thing. But if suddenly, I don't know, if the ceiling were to rip off of the grocery store and then there's an interdimensional being there, so these things are defying your expectations. This doesn't make any sense. Quite outside the realm of normalcy. So to feel awe, people say you have to have those two components. Feel something bigger than your sense of self, something vast, and then something that defies your expectations. Anyone who has experienced a psychedelic or knows a little bit about psychedelics, probably going right about now like, oh, hell yeah. Well, psychedelics, a psychedelic experience, yeah, that seems pretty right for feeling awe, right? We're talking about people often having this deep sense of, say, unity, connection to something larger than you, to others, whatever that might be, ergo a sense of vastness. And then expectation defined, well, I mean, think about a psychedelic experience, right? It's often these things that folks who have taken it for the first time in their life, have never had anything like it, or even those who have experienced it many different times, it's still bringing up new feelings, experiences, sensations and whatnot that are quite different. So with that, I'd say that like a psychedelic experience is in a way almost like a prototypical source of awe. Because of what it can involve, kind of experiences that it can bring about.
Yeah, I definitely think it's something that really captures like the core essence of what psychedelics can produce. Because like mystical experience can be a bit jargony, a bit overly religious for some people. Ego dissolution too Freudian, but basic emotion that can be evoked so many different ways. Quite interesting. And then another thing I don't think we quite touched on a ton is how awe can have all these different sort of downstream effects on how people like interact with each other and the health impacts as well. So maybe you could tell us a bit about that.
Yeah. So, right. When to feel awe, you have those different components we mentioned, vastness, need for accommodation. One of the things that seems to underlie these effects that we've seen. So some of the most salient effects of all, the ones that have been like more robustly noted, are a sense of connection to others, aspects of like behavior or feelings that relate in a way more pro-socially to other people, so generosity or feeling more generous. There's also aspects of, I think I mentioned earlier, of feeling a little bit less stressed about your day-to-day activities and things like that. Well, one of the things that people have found that seems to consistently underlie those outcomes, that seems to be like a psychological mechanism, is you have a smaller sense of self. So like literally like you're feeling as though who I am has been like diminished in some way. And there's a few different components here, right? You can have, there's a sense of self that feels like literally smaller. Like I'm a teeny tiny little infinitesimal like speck in the universe. And then there's a sense of self that feels small, vis-a-vis something bigger than you. So compared to something, the sense of something larger than you, you feel small. There's something bigger than you out there, whatever that might be. And those things, especially the one like feeling something larger than your sense of self, seems to be a mechanism through which people feel these or report these different effects regarding pro-sociality, connection, and so on. And the thinking there is that by decreasing your sense of self, by decreasing the focus that you have, this like self-importance that's there, it opens you up to being more attuned to like the needs and the contributions of others and other things stemming from that. So it's thought to, maybe it's a bit of a hydraulic thing. There's some discussion there whether it's hydraulic or whether, yes, your sense of self is maybe just shifting a little bit more to be more malleable to holding in now others' existence and like acknowledging them and seeing them there. But something about like feeling this smaller sense of self makes it so that people feel more connected to others, more wanting to see what their needs are and feel about them. Awe also increases a sense of humility, where people are acknowledging where others have played a role in their life or benefits or those sorts of things. As I mentioned, like lower stress. So people who feel awe, they report like the smaller sense of self, and they report that their day-to-day stressors just don't seem that big in the grand scheme of things, right? Here's this experience that's kind of making you look outside your sense of self. This is why awe is considered a, quote, like self-transcendent emotion, because it literally kind of pulls you outside of yourself. It transcends the self in a way. And by virtue of doing that, kind of like open you up to these other bigger things, you're going, okay, these day-to-day things I'm like worried about, yeah, you know, they matter and that kind of thing, but it's a little bit less right now when I have this other perspective in mind. Now, I'm not saying, right, just like with psychedelics, that awe is a panacea or it can solve everything. But it seems as though it's something that can at least start to shift your perspective a little bit.
Yeah, it's definitely something that people can cultivate and improve their lives just by finding more of it in the everyday, it seems like. You've also, I think, written a bit on other self-transcendent emotions. Maybe you could tell us a bit about that as well.
Yeah, so there's this thinking that there's like a suite of different experiences and emotions that you can have, right, that kind of pull you outside of your sense of self, or at least attune you to things beyond just yourself. So to just mention, right, like awe, by virtue of like making you feel smaller, that kind of thing, self-transcendent. What are the other emotions that seem to do that? Compassion is like a prototypical one. So compassion, it's defined as like you notice someone else's suffering and you want to do something to alleviate that suffering. So there's an aspect of that. Like if we take self-transcendent more, I guess like more, I don't know if literally is the right term, but a little less mystical sounding, I guess. Here's like an emotion where you are recognizing something outside of you, something outside of your sense of self, another person, what have you, that is in need and that motivates you to want to help them. It's self-transcendent in a way. The other one that's like kind of a quintessential self-transcendent emotion is gratitude. So once again, you notice that someone else has played a role. You're acknowledging that someone else has like played a role to where you've gotten, to helping you out along those lines. And gratitude has been shown to motivate reciprocity. So it's like a strengthening of relationships. You see that someone else has like helped you out. You feel grateful for that. You want to go and then reciprocate that in a way. Self-transcendent in that regard. Again, outside of yourself, other sort of people. And I would also consider it like it's in the suite of kind of like emotions that are socially oriented in that way, or more like socially, let's say, what's the word I'm looking for? Attuned or approach oriented, where you notice someone who is in need of help, compassion, you want to go and help them. It's approaching them. Gratitude, you've seen that someone has benefited you in some way, you want to reciprocate that, you're approaching them, and strengthen these relationships in different regards. Awe is obviously, it's a funky one. It's more within that realm of the mystical-y, kind of funky weirdness out there, smaller sense of self, bigger things than you. But it also makes people feel connected, right? They feel connected to others in general. And then they want to help others out. They feel more pro-social. They feel more generous in certain games where they have people see if, you know, how much money do they want to bet, donate to another person. Someone who's feeling awe wants to do that as well. So that's what I would consider like in a host of self-transcendent emotions. There's other ones out there, I think, that's just like a little bit less well-known. Things like moral elevation has been talked about. It's a little bit more squishy and abstract in my mind. If you feel, let's see, you feel an elevation in the sense of this sort of kind of like a boosting effect that you see from others, like moral well-doing or kind of like benefits that come across. Again, I think that more needs to be done there, but you can think of these self-transcendent emotions as something that's a little bit more than tuning you outside of yourself to others.
Yeah, it sounds like there's a lot to explore there, and awe really only is like one aspect of it. I guess going forward, how could you imagine that like studying psychedelics, we could really more carefully break down like what is happening with all these different self-transcendent emotions and how they play a role and if people, you know, have benefits and whatnot?
Yeah. So as we're trying to understand why psychedelics have their benefits, I think it's like important to piece apart as much as we can different aspects of the psychedelic experience. So I'm not saying, right, that one thing is going to be the end-all be-all for others. I'm sure we're going to find out at the end of the day it's going to be not a nature versus nurture thing, but it's going to be a combination of, say, neurobiological underpinnings are very important. We're going to talk about plasticity and other sorts of aspects like that. But it also seems as though the psychological experience might have an important role to play in the benefits that people feel, whether it's the insights that they get, the sense of meaning, and what might be in the temporal kind of line of experiences people might have in their psychological component of it, of their psychedelic experience, could also be emotions. So when we think about like what emotions typically do, right, there's often there's an appraisal of something. So you notice something bigger than you, outside your sense of self, it's expectation-defying. You feel this awe. Awe promotes you to feel other sorts of things down the line. And maybe there's a host of things that stem from that. Maybe that's where certain insights come from. Maybe that's why people tend to feel more connected to others through psychedelic experience, at least if we think about it psychologically. I think it's important here just because if we already know from this rich experimental literature on distinct emotions that there are one distinct emotions that gratitude, awe, compassion, sadness, anger, what have you, are distinct states that people can have. That's one. And then two, if we also recognize that those distinct states have distinct profiles of downstream effects, of whether they are benefits, behaviors, different impacts on cognition, then those things will be really important to consider and fold into our scientific understanding of psychedelics and their mechanisms of action. So right now, right, we've dedicated a huge degree of scientific effort to understanding, say, mystical experience, and like you mentioned, like ego dissolution, other things like that. I think, you know, those scales have been important and useful to look at for a while now. But if you start looking at them, there's ways in which they can be improved. And I think one of the clearest ways is like through their assessment of emotion. Things like the mystical experience questionnaire that's so frequently used, or the altered states of consciousness scale, have aspects of it that literally mention awe, but it might just be like one item or so. And the ways they capture kind of other aspects of positive emotion are even squishier. So if we can come at capturing the psychedelic experience with a little bit more granularity, I think that'll be valuable just to understand how feeling different emotions might relate to some of these downstream outcomes that people are feeling. So from decreases in anxiety, where might that stem from? Is because they had a mystical experience? Underlying that mystical experience is because they felt connected to others, a sense of unity. Underlying that sense of unity and connection, is it coming from a certain emotion? Is it coming from that they felt like a smaller sense of self? Because if we start to drill down on that, right, the idea then is that you might be able to develop interventions that are all the more attuned to cultivating certain experiences. And, you know, I think awe is incredibly fascinating and cool, but maybe it isn't that. But I think just by asking it, it's going to be valuable for us to uncover and be able to better understand why psychedelics have the benefits that they do, and why there might be some other ways that we can improve our existing interventions.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah, it definitely seems like there was a lot of early work done that got the basics sort of covered, and now it's really time to refine, like, what is actually going on? What are these specific positive emotions that occur during psychedelics? How can we amplify them with different interventions during the acute effects, all of that? Another cool study I saw that you did recently was comparing the risk and benefits of psychedelics to cannabis. I thought that was cool because, you know, oftentimes psychedelics and cannabis are kind of seen as being in the same sort of family, but there's some distinctions as well.
Yeah. So the thought process there was that as we're trying to understand psychedelics better and what their benefits are, we also, of course, want to understand what their risks are. That's still very important, right? We know they're not a panacea. We know that they're certainly like aspects of the risks have been overblown in decades past, but we also want to be realistic about like what are the ways in which, you know, they might be have some harms to them in certain ways, in certain contexts. And by virtue of wanting to understand that, it's difficult to look at just psychedelics benefits and risks in a vacuum, right? You want to be able to say, okay, maybe people have certain degrees of hospitalizations or these increases in these emotions or decreases, but relative to what, really? And this is building upon, once again, like other like valuable work that's out there already, but just as science is like an incremental business or endeavor in a way that you, there's always like ways that you can improve upon it. So prior work that looked at psychedelics risks often looks at it through like convenient samples of where they're just like, maybe they're putting their survey out there on Twitter or onto psychedelic like forums, that sort of thing. So who are the people who are self-selecting for that, right? And especially if the survey is marketed as, hey, we're asking about your challenging experiences with psychedelics. So who's going to come and talk about that? Maybe it's the people who've had the worst experiences possible. Maybe it's the people who've had bad experiences, but they still like psychedelics and they want to talk about it to some degree. And so you can imagine that that may or may not be like inflating certain things that you get, certain rates. So this study was an effort to try and go about that in a little bit more of a systematic way. So we wanted to not only not pose this, like advertise the study as just a study on psychedelics challenging experiences. We didn't like mention that at all in how we advertise it, how we talk about the study. We also went about it on a slightly more rigorous way of collecting participants. So online panel-based service that tries to be more demographically representative of the U.S. population in terms of ethnicity and age and gender. And then, as was mentioned earlier, we didn't want to look at it in just a vacuum. So we have psychedelics, we can ask about psychedelics, but again, like compared to what? And for us, cannabis came up as one of the clearest like examples or comparators of, so we want to look at psychedelics use in a recreational setting. What tends to be one of the most popular like psychoactive substances that people would use recreationally in the States? But cannabis. And so that would allow us to give like a little bit more of just a juxtaposition to look at this. And we found, you know, it's not like a big surprise, but psychedelics have more reported benefits than cannabis, but they're also more reported risks. Now, most of these are still like in the single digits, within like, you know, around the 5, 6, 7 percentage points of, in terms of, are people feeling as though that they were going to harm others while on psychedelics? Do people feel as though they were going to be violent? Did they report needing to go to a hospital or whatnot? And that tended to be slightly more than cannabis, which honestly isn't that surprising. But then you can also look at what were the purported benefits. This is all self-reported, of course, so that the caveat here is that you're getting people to report not only on an experience that happened in the past, but, you know, something that did recreationally, not in a clinical setting. And I think it's just valuable for us to continue to like build on that kind of information, because there are still people out there. I don't know if you have like family members or folks like this, but I can remember like the first time I told my dad what my new job was going to be. He's like, "Whoa, wait, mushrooms? Like that's that thing that people jump out of windows on, right?" And it's such an old like an old story in a way that obviously has like been out there for decades and so on. And I think as we continue to talk about the therapeutic benefits that psychedelics might have and to think about how that might scale upwards, it's going to be important to know what those benefits are for people outside of the clinical environment, because it's just going to happen if like these treatments become legal at a larger scale, that people are going to continue likely using it in a recreational setting. So it's helpful to build out those rates and to help providers understand what can happen in regards to benefits and also regards to the risks as well, to say, look, again, it's got some benefits that are really cool. It's got some risks that are also important, but then let's also compare it to some other things that people do. And when you look at it, you know, the picture, it's not like this clear thing of like, oh, this is a drug that's got all of these difficulties. Now, of course, we're looking at this writ large. We're looking at it in an average sense, and there's going to be different populations for whom it could be more risky or less risky. These are all just the nuances, right? Like, you know this, of like doing science and trying to communicate these kind of things with others. So it was just part of an effort that we're trying to do now. And we're right now, as we speak, we're collecting data on an even larger survey that's using a nationally representative data set of a couple thousand people. Real rigorous, complicated system of like weighting demographics to the general U.S. census to make it as accurate as possible. We talk about like the sample that we got of racial distribution, of age distribution, sex distribution, and so on, which is all the more important when we're trying to talk about, again, rates that these things might be happening at.
Makes a lot of sense. Yeah. More nuance is always needed, so. Yeah.
Might not always be the sexiest thing, but it's important.
For sure. Well, I think that's like most of what I wanted to talk about. Is there anything else that you think our listeners might appreciate hearing about? Or
that's a great question. I mean, I think it's just important for us to continue. I'm biased to be interested in the psychological experience of psychedelics. And I think it's just going to be important for us to continue to be open-minded to finding new ways to exploring how that unfolds for people. You know, precision psychiatry is becoming more and more popular and thinking about how certain treatments can be individualized for people. And obviously, you know, thinking about scale and unfortunately in here in the US, like the price of what that would entail is important. But I think there's a lot there to be said in terms of understanding a person's like individual experience and journey and how that might play a role in their psychedelic experience and then also in their the experience that they have afterwards, their downstream circumstances and so on. So I would just say like it's just going to be important and interesting and valuable to continue to think about that moving forward. Where are people coming from? What are their demographics? What's their socioeconomic status? Where's their mindset currently? We've talked about, yes, so much about set and setting, but I think there's still a lot more there to explore and to be said, especially at an individual level. When it's just by nature of what we do and the science that looking at things in aggregate has been common and will remain to be common for a variety of different reasons. But finding individualized approaches, I think, is going to be a really interesting, valuable way moving forward to think about constructive interventions and how psychedelics work.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for joining today.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. This is a real joy.